All right, I got my water here. I got my little back pillow to preserve the curve in my spine. I'm ready. I'm ready to do this. I've got a stack of index cards here. I'm trying to do this on index cards because I don't know. I get tired of staring at the screen, and it's too easy to write too many notes when you do it on the computer. So I'm going analog right now. I'm going analog with this one. So what I want to talk about today, I want to talk about two things that seem like they're not related. I didn't think were related, but the more I stewed on them, especially over the holiday, the more I realized that, they're intertwined. I couldn't even separate the two things if I wanted to. They're so connected. And the two things are note-taking and mental health. What's really humorous to me right now is, maybe to some degree, this beginning sounds organized to you, but you have no idea what's going on right now. This computer has been stopping my recordings in the middle of me speaking. I don't know what's going on. You know, maybe it has something to do with this update. Anyways, we're going to keep going. So if you notice maybe a few spots where the timing of what I say is weird, it might be because the recorder kicked off and I came back in and tried to pick up where I left off. But we'll see. Let's talk a little bit about seasonal affective disorder, though. That's where I want to start, because I don't talk about this a lot. To be honest, when it comes to pretty much anything, like other than what I'm interested in, I'm not really much of a talker about me. You know, like I will talk about stories. I will talk about shared experiences. I will talk about things that I've learned and things that I know and things that I think I know and dumbass opinions that I argue with people over for no reason. But when it comes to how I'm feeling, if I'm having difficulties or things like that, I don't know. Maybe it's my, a small part of my bloodline is English. Maybe from the English, I inherited that stiff upper lip thing. Or maybe it's just because I grew up an only child. But I don't know. It's not something I've ever done, really. Every once in a while, I'll share something, but for the most part, I'm really self-contained, which in some ways, very good. But as you can imagine, in other ways, it's awful. It's a bad habit to have, or not even a bad habit. I think that minimizes it. It's a bad way of being for a lot of things. And one of the hardest things for me is winter every year. And it's only as I've gotten older, and I think that's just because of repetition, that I realized winter was a problem. You know, the more winters you go through, the more you start to see patterns. And maybe that threshold, that number that makes something obvious, is different for everybody. Because it seems to me like it's taken me almost 40 to figure that out. Although, you know, let's be honest, I don't remember if I went through stuff like this when I was younger, because the generation that I am, we didn't have these words. We weren't aware of these things when I was growing up. So when you're not aware of them and they're not given vocabulary, you don't look for them. You just think that, you know, it is what it is. For example, you know, like anxiety, we talk a lot about anxiety in modern society, but even if you went back 60, 70 years ago and tried to ask people, do you ever feel anxious? They probably would have looked at you like there was something wrong with you. Like, no, I don't feel anxious, because what they defined as anxious was like this, was something closer to like the strict dictionary definition. They didn't see anxiety as like this mental state of being that a lot of people experience. That doesn't mean that they didn't experience back then. They just didn't know that's what it was. You know, there's certain things like when women would have strong emotional states because of their cycle. Back then, they would refer to it sometimes as hysteria. Now, a lot of the reason for that, of course, was misogyny. You know, like they're just basically just saying that they were dumb. You know, like they're dumb and they're crazy. But now we know a little bit more about science. And we know that sometimes the hormones in a woman's body can make her experience things that aren't in the parameters of normal for her. That's a difficult thing. But the terminology is, oh, it's hysteria. They're crazy. They didn't understand this other state yet. Because we hadn't, part of it, because we hadn't given it vocabulary. And one of those things is the seasonal affective disorder. I'm not a big fan of the name because it's kind of pathetic, really. It's a pathetic name. It's seasonal affective disorder. Why is it seasonal affective disorder? Because they really wanted it to spell SAD. They really wanted the acronym to say SAD. So they stretched the words seasonal affective. What the fuck does that mean, really? It could have been, I mean, even disorder. And that was like the catchphrase, I guess, at the time, because in reality, it's closer to seasonal affective depression. But whatever, that's the term they chose. For me, I experience it every year. And every year, winter is brutal for me. It's a very difficult time for me. I've heard a lot of explanations as to why this is. People say that it's because of a deficiency in vitamin D or deficiency of vitamin K because you're not getting enough sunlight. Well, I can tell you that that's not exactly accurate. I wouldn't have been able to tell you before, probably this year, but this fall, we're heading into winter now, this fall so far in California hasn't really been cloudy. It hasn't really rained. It's been, even on the cold days, it's been mostly sunny. So I've been getting plenty of sun and hasn't made a difference. Now, four things I noticed this year. I noticed that there are four things that happen to me every winter. Some of them, like seasonal affective disorder, have something to do with the way my body functions or whatever it is. And some of them are just weird coincidences, I guess, that it happens. But I would say that the four things that happen to me every year have happened at least 4 years in a row. And those are: something invariably goes wrong with my teeth. Last year, just before Christmas, like 2 days before Christmas, or even on, no, I think it was actually even on Christmas Eve, I had to have a root canal done because a tooth from years ago that had been root canaled suddenly went bad. And the year before that, I don't remember what it was. I had a cavity or something like that. And this year, I had another problem. And number two thing that always seems to go wrong, that seems to coincide, of course, with needing dental work, is money. I invariably have something come up that's unexpected other than the dental work, because the dental work would be a second thing on top of that. That screws up my finances for November and December and January, for that matter. Something, you know, like back when I had a car, it would be something went wrong with my car. And then a dental thing would happen. Number three, my body. And this is more, those two things, I would say teeth and money, it's just weird probability that those happened. But the body thing, I understand why it happens. Because of years of anxiety and now what I believe to be, that I'm in a state of recovery with severe anxiety, it puts my body into an equilibrium, a very delicate equilibrium. And what I mean by that is I'm riding a fence most of the year. As long as I'm rolling and things are good, I feel good, things are okay. But one little tumble here or there, and it sets things out of balance. And it's tied with my number four, which my number four is mental. So my body and my mental situation are tied together. And I'm not saying, you know, like I end up with a broken leg or anything like that. I've actually made it through 43 years of my life without ever breaking a bone in my body, which is unbelievable considering some of the stuff I did when I was a kid. I jumped off a barn a couple times. Anyways, the stuff that I'm talking about with my body is I consider anxiety partially physical, especially when it has to do with racing heartbeat and skipping heartbeat. That's tied inextricably with a mental situation. But then there's also the, you know, like the blood sugar and the cholesterol and these kind of body things. Blood pressure, very much tied to mental. So invariably, when winter comes and winter sets my body just a little out of balance because of whatever it is, you know, whether it's they're right that it's vitamin K or vitamin D deficiency or whatever, or maybe that my body just doesn't like lower temperatures for sustained periods of time, it knocks my equilibrium off kilter. And then my mental situation goes with it. And I usually start, I've experienced a lot of depression during winter and fall for that matter. And if we have a very rainy spring, then as well. Basically, if it's not sunny, I have problems with depression. And, you know, some of it's tied in with these other things. You know, if you're having problems with money, you're probably having problems with your teeth and your body feels weird. Yeah, you're going to feel anxiety. You're going to feel depression. That's understandable. But what I'm talking about is more, it's a different kind of depression. For anybody that's suffered from seasonal depression, I'm going to leave the A out because I think it's extreme. It's not needed. If you've experienced this, you know that this depression, it's like a general malaise is a good way to say it. You're not depressed about a specific thing. You're not down on life. You're just, you feel like Eeyore. You're like, okay, guess I'll get up and do something today. Just sitting here watching TV again. That's the general state. So it's very easy to go lower when you're already like your zero. You know, your starting point is already lower into like that Eeyore stage. It's easier to go into a lower place. So I think that has a lot to do with this, you know, something about the winter, it brings me down into a lower state. Maybe part of my biology is trying to tell me to hibernate, but it brings me down into a lower state. And then because I'm in that lower state, I end up in sadder places and more difficult places. And, you know, I was trying to explain this to somebody and what I had a big problem with, other than the acronym, you know, SAD, which I've already talked about, the ridiculousness of that. The other wording that we use for this stuff, it just doesn't work for me. Mental health, that's the most popular term, the most positive term, I guess, people use. But it's not accurate, is it? We're not talking about my health, right? When we have a broken foot, we don't say, let's take care of your ankle health. We say, let's take care of your ankle problem. You know, when you have the flu, you don't say, oh, let's deal with my health situation. Say, no, let's deal with my sickness. So mental health is just, is this term like almost to make a positive of something that it's not positive. It's not horrible end of the world, but it's not positive. It sucks. Having mental health issues sucks. But that's how we do it, right? It's not that mental health, it's that you have a mental health issue. And I don't know, like an issue. You know, like issues like something like, you know, you go to the complaints department. You know, I'm having an issue with my car. having an issue. I bought this jacket and the buttons fell off. I have an issue. So the terminology there bothers me too. And then the other end of it is the mental illness. Now, I like this term to a certain degree because even though we use it as it's like a ultimate term, you know, like mental illness, oh, someone's mentally ill, you know, that means that they're psychotic or that they're psychopathic or that they're schizophrenic. That's mental illness. But to me, illness is like minimized, right? An illness is it's something small, something like something maybe that we should be applying to something like depression or anxiety. You know, they're a big deal, but they're not a psychotic big deal. They're not a, I'm having hallucinations big deal. So illness should seem like the right term, but the problem with illness that I have is illness is it's short term, right? A cold is an illness. You have it and then it goes away. A flu is an illness. You have it and it goes away. Chickenpox is an illness. You have it and it goes away. Depression is not an illness. You have it and it goes into remission. But it never goes away. Anxiety goes into remission, but it never goes away. These things, they're long-term problems. They're not temporary things like the word illness would insinuate. So I think the most accurate term, but the term that nobody's going to want to use is mental handicap. Because we think of mental handicap as a learning disability. You know, mental handicap might be autism or even dyslexia, which I have. It's a mental handicap. I think that anxiety and depression are mental handicaps as well. Personally, nobody has to agree with me on this. I'm just telling you how I feel when I think of these words and I try to talk about this stuff and why the words are so difficult for me because none of them really work. You know, I can feel however I want about the term mental handicap, but I can't go out there and start using it because everybody else is going to take it a different way. So my communication will be hampered. And for someone who already doesn't like to talk about this stuff, or just, I mean, it's not even that I don't like to, someone who just is conditioned not to talk about this stuff, using words that put other people off is going to make it even worse for me and make me less likely to do it. So I think what I'm saying here is it's not that we need to use the word mental handicap or the words mental handicap, is that the idea behind it is what we should be looking at, right? Because first of all, there's nothing to be ashamed of if you have a handicap. Just because you suffer from anxiety, you suffer from depression, you suffer from anything in that realm, there should be no more shame than if you don't have a leg below the knee or you're blind. You know, we don't shame blind people. We don't shame deaf people. Why do we shame people with mental handicaps? So I think that's part of the reason people are not willing to use the word is because as much as they say that they don't have a negative connotation attached with the idea of being a handicap, I think they do because they don't like to use it. But handicap is the right way of thinking about this because a handicap is long-term. You're not going to grow your leg back and you're not going to miraculously take a pill and 2 weeks later never have to take a pill again and never have to deal with depression again. These things are with you. But there's treatment. There's no cure for these things, but there are treatments. There are ways to adjust the way you live. You will have a different life, but you will have a new life. Life is still good. You can still enjoy and love life. You know, a person who is paralyzed, paraplegic or quadriplegic, they have to use a wheelchair to get around. but they can still have a normal life in every other way, right? You know, they have to worry about whether there's a ramp to get into certain buildings and things like that, but it doesn't mean they can't fall in love and they can't, you know, they're still human beings. They're just handicapped. And that's the same way we should be looking at depression and anxiety. There's no shame about it. You have this, and we can help. We, as in the medical establishment and your friends and your family, we can help you to learn to live with it and to make that life, that new happy life with it. So I like that terminology because I think I have an enormous respect for people who have physical handicaps and learning disabilities as well. There's tremendous respect for these people. I think they are brave, but I don't want to overplay the brave thing because I think that plays into the shame thing too. But I think that what they're doing, working through this stuff and making lives for themselves, despite whatever this situation is, that's something that people with depression and anxiety should be looking to as an example. Now, once I said, like I just said, don't make it a big deal because the more you feed into that big deal of it, the more you're saying, oh, I feel sorry for them. I don't feel sorry for them because many of them have better lives than I do because they have a better mindset than I do. And that's why someone who suffers with seasonal depression and suffers with anxiety, why I need to look to these people. Because what you're doing, I should be doing. I should be able to get my mind set. You know, this is it's just like having to step over a stone. Now, you could stop and stare at the stone and say, I can't go any further because there's a stone here. Or you can say, yep, there's a stone here and I can step over it and I can step around it. And that's the mindset. That's why I like the term handicap, for mental handicap, because that's the mindset that I want. I can move through this. I can move through this. Is it difficult? At times, yes, but I can move through this. So I just want to get those terms out because they're muddy for me and I like to work through those things. But I guess a word for this kind of stuff that I'm talking about is coping. Now, some people might have connotations to that word. But I think coping to me just means working with something. I don't actually know the etymology of the word, but I like that it begins with C-O. Because C-O, co, in certain words, if it means with, you know, co-partner, partner with, co-worker, worker with. So I like coping. It's like being with for me. You know, ing is like being. So coping is like being with this situation. But as I said, you know, one of my ways of coping with seasonal depression and depression in general is drawing inward. And it's not a removing myself from other people, but that's how I work through things. Is I really go, I'm doing work. I'm just doing internal work. That's why over the years I've found the journaling to be a very healthy habit, because journaling can help me to do that, but also do it in a more external way. You know, I might not be telling other people about it, but I am forcing articulation. You know, sometimes when we get drawn into our head and we're dealing with things, we're dealing with it in almost a nonverbal way. We're spinning things in our head, but we're not articulating them. So it can be hard to move through things because they remain intangible. But the moment we begin to articulate them, the moment we begin to try to use words, like what I was just doing there, working through definitions of words, the moment you can start to do that, you give yourself Lego blocks. And once you have the blocks, then you can begin to build something. But you need the blocks first. So journaling's always been really important to me because it forces articulation on me to find the words. They might not be the right words, but they're words. And when I know it's the wrong word, I can work to find the right word. I might write down health and think, no, illness. And then think, no, handicap. And it moves me somewhere. And that movement is progress. Not progress as in I'm curing this, but progress in as in working through it. And maybe because of this seasonal depression, I've been feeling more and more the pull toward my notebook. Not just to journal, but just to use my notebook. There's something very comforting to me about paper, about pen and paper. There's something about it that feels grounding. And it's probably because, you know, I grew up, as I said earlier, I grew up an only child, and I would spend a lot of time watching television, cartoons, and stuff like that. And while I was doing that, I always had paper and pens and crayons and markers, and I'd be drawing or writing while I was doing all that. So it brings me back to a sense of who I am, almost a precognitive sense of who I am. You know, I wasn't thinking about who I was then. So it brings me back to a place before the language of it exists. You know, it's just this internal sense of being. And in the last episode, I talked a little bit about notebooks. I talked about Bruce Chatwin's wife, Elizabeth, how she said in that YouTube video, the thing about phones and how her husband would live with thoughts in his head in the notebook. And I actually had something written down that I wanted to say about that, else about that, and I didn't say it in the episode. And I was a little bummed at first, but now I'm glad I did because it fits into this episode much, much better. One of the things I was contemplating after watching that video, after listening to that little bit of the interview with Elizabeth, was this idea, you know, the phone thing. What if instead of immediately sending a text message to somebody, when I have something to say to them, what if I wrote it down in my notebook? And I lived with that for a little while. You know, obviously, if it's something that needs an immediate response, you know, like somebody's at the store, which tea did you want? Yes, I want the traditional medicines, chamomile and lavender tea, please. That needs immediate response. But I mean, something that you're trying to start a conversation with someone via text message or maybe even just a phone call. What if you wrote that down? What if I wrote that down in my notebook and let it live there for a little bit before I did it? Would that enhance the power of my communication? That was the question I had. I haven't tried this yet, but I've been contemplating it. And when we go through the rest of this, you'll see that it probably will be something I'm going to be trying soon because it's going to fit in really well with what I'm doing now, what I've just started doing. The other thing about notebooks, about paper notebooks, is being drawn to them and wanting to do more notes in them. So like when I'm reading, watching and stuff like this, instead of going to the digital right away, I've always tried to draw myself into the paper first. And it's a calling, like I said, maybe back to that primordial sense of self. It also prevents me from experiencing some of the anxiety that comes from staring at a screen for too long. But it's also, for some reason, it's just something that comes up all the time. Old episodes of podcasts, you might hear me say it. In old tweets, you might be able to find me continually saying, I need to live in my notebook more. But the problem with this drawing towards wanting to do the notebook more is the pull of digital notes, right? So if you want to make a second brain, it's a very popular terminology right now, you want to create a second brain, that means eventually you got to take those paper notes and put them in the computer. That's something that's just insinuated by the fact that you have digital notes and you have paper notes. It's an insinuation that eventually the paper notes will be transcribed to digital. Sorry. Lost control of my tongue right there. And because of that, because of understanding that, that pull towards the notebook could never be really released. So I was stuck with this kind of unresolved, I don't want to call it problem, but unresolved situation. When you're being drawn towards something, but then something else is also repelling you. You live in this corner, this kind of limbo. And I never really thought a lot about that. But then I've started listening to this new podcast. It's not a new podcast in the sense that it's been around for years, I think. It's new to me. And it's called the Blind Boy Podcast. And I just, it's actually, if you enjoy this podcast, you'll probably enjoy that one because it's similar format. He turns on the microphone and he talks and it's just him. And it's not scripted. It's like this, conversational. The way that I like to refer to it, you know, by now is like a late night radio show from my imaginary past where that may never have existed. But in his recent episode called Fanta Hammer, he talks about mental health. And his way of looking at it really, when you deal with anxiety and depression, you're drawn to read and listen to things about mental health because you want to feel better, right? You want to find things that help. But at a certain point, you listen to so much, you hear the same shit over and over again. It's not shit, but the same ideas are propagated again and again. Why? Because they helped a lot of people. So there's an assumption that they will help everyone, or at least an insinuation, right? So you hear them repeated again and again. Meditation, that's one that you hear a lot. And meditation is helpful. But what I enjoyed about this episode of the Blind Boy Podcast is he made me see something that I had never seen before. What he talks about in this episode actually refers to the episode before, which I don't have the name of right here. But if you can find that one, you can easily find out what the episode before that was called. In the episode before that, he talked about the idea of the gestalt. I'm not going to explain what a gestalt is. Boil it down right here and just say it means something complete, the wholeness of something. That drastically undercuts the definition, but it will help you understand what I'm saying about this enough for me to get through this without having to jump into Freud and Jung. In the Fanta Hammer episode, he refers back to the idea of the gestalt. And he talks about this idea for him. He says that he can see anxiety or depression coming like a month before it happens. When I heard that, he got my attention. He got my attention because my experience or my understanding was always that these situations were spontaneous. That something happened and then boom, oh, I'm depressed. Or sometimes even nothing happened. And boom, I'm depressed. And the same thing for anxiety. That these were spontaneous things that you couldn't see coming. So here's this audacious claim that he says he can see it a month before. And then he goes to explain it and kind of he rocks my world. Because what he says essentially is it starts with a gestalt, an unresolved gestalt. Kind of like what I just said about my notebook thing being unresolved. You have this thing dangling, you know, this thread that's dangling. And that becomes the catalyst for what essentially can become an avalanche in a month later into depression and anxiety. That there's a loose thread, that there's something unresolved. For him, it's like an unanswered email is the example he gives. Someone sends him a business email of some sort and he sits on it because he doesn't feel like dealing with it. And then over time, that becomes something else. And I started to think about that idea. I started to think about that in my life, because I've definitely been to the point where I would get an email and like, oh, don't want to deal with that. And I started to wonder if he was right. Like, if I could find these loose threads and just go complete those, would I be able to prevent falling into a bout of depression or a bout of anxiety? And as I'm in the end of fall and the beginning of winter here and going through seasonal depression, I started to wonder if that could affect that. That if instead of burrowing or the temptation or the desire to burrow, if I could just become a little more productive. I don't like that word in this context. If I could become more, if I could just go around picking up loose threads and completing those loose threads, would winter become a little bit easier? You know, I'm not looking for a miracle here. But if it gave me 10, 15% relief, that would be huge. Because as I said, it's a delicate balance. That 10, 15% can be enough to shift the whole mass of mental, of the mental state for a season. So I've been spinning that idea in my head. And because of that, I started to notice these loose threads. I noticed that, for example, I've been having, like I said, I always have money. Something with money always comes up in the winter. Well, I have some bills that I haven't been able to pay 100% of. I've been sending them money, but not 100%. So they call me, and they call me. Well, I've been avoiding calling them. And I had the dental issue that I mentioned. And I avoided calling the dentist. Like, why did I avoid calling the dentist? I started asking myself that. And I think, I'm not positive if Blind Boy says this or if this is something I came to in my contemplation, but I started to think about a precipitating event. I started to think about those loose threads. Is there one loose thread that starts everything? In the sense that because I didn't do this thing, I felt overwhelmed. I felt a little tired mentally, and I didn't want to do this thing, which is second in line. And then by the time I got further down the line, then I was mentally exhausted, and I didn't want to call the dentist. I didn't want to call the credit card company. Was there a big bang moment, let's say? So I started to look around at all the things that I was avoiding, all the things I didn't want to do, wondering what this initial event, this initial loose thread could be. And the first thing I noticed is this is my room. Now, when I say my room's a mess, you know, it's not full of garbage and stuff like that, but it's just so many things out of place. You know, like somebody bought a little sweater for the dog. And instead of putting it away where I put all of the little dog sweaters and stuff I have, I left it on the shelf. And next to it on the shelf are four bottles, empty bottles of my medicine that I need to rip the labels off of and recycle. And then on the shelf under that, there's like four or five pieces of mail that I haven't gone through for some reason. On the shelf below that, there's a t-shirt that somebody gave me that I've, for some reason, haven't moved into the clothes drawer. All these little things, you know, like there's the label from the box that Amazon sent me that I want to shred. This popsicle stick that's here. I don't even remember the last time I had a popsicle. Why is that here? All these little things. So I started to think, that's it. My environment is messy, and because my environment is messy, everything else is wearing me out. But I couldn't get myself to start doing it. I couldn't get myself to, you know what, I'm just going to clean this shelf. You know, not even that little trick that you can do with yourself. I'm just going to clean this 1 3-by-3 spot. So there's this other unresolved thing, right? I'm seeing the problem. I think I'm seeing the problem, but I'm not taking action to do anything about it. Anybody that suffers with depression knows that state of mind well. I can see what's wrong, but I'm not going to do anything about it. So then a weird thing happened. This is where note-taking really starts to come in. I can't believe I'm at 43 minutes here. I better talk faster. I have as much time as I want. I like to, you know, I love note-taking. I love note-taking apps. I love paper note-taking. I love notes because I love thoughts. And those two things are tied together for me. So I tend to watch those kind of things when I watch YouTube. And because of that, YouTube does a mediocre job of understanding that. I say that because in all honesty, YouTube's algorithm sucks. I could watch 100 videos about note-taking and it will give me a video about note-taking every couple days. But if I watch one video about a comic book movie, my YouTube will be flooded with other videos about comic book movies. I don't understand it. But because of that, this one chance encounter, this video pops up about this note-taking app called Obsidian. Now, you may, if you've been around, you might know that my note-taking app is Rome. I use Rome Research. And if you know what Rome Research is, then you probably know what Obsidian is, because as far as competitors, those two are the closest. They're the closest to each other. At least that's the way people think about it. Once you start to learn more about the way both apps work, they're really actually different. They're made for different purposes. But anyways, because I'm a Rome Research user, I don't typically watch videos about Obsidian when they come up. Just like people that use Microsoft Word probably don't watch a lot of videos about Google Docs. Not that you hate the app or you're against the app or whatever, you just don't use it. So why would you learn about something you're not using, right? It's kind of the methodology. But something about this video made me maybe want to click it. Maybe it was just a really great thumbnail. I'm starting to learn that people are right, that good thumbnails really do make you click things. So I started watching this video, and what they were talking about in the Obsidian video is the graph view. And this is where we get to talk about stuff that's even harder to explain than stuff going on in my head. If you don't know what the graph view is, essentially apps like Rome Research and Obsidian, they connect other notes to each other. Best way to think about it is like Wikipedia. You know, if you go to Wikipedia about Star Wars, there's a link to Luke Skywalker in that article. If you click the link to go to Luke Skywalker and you read the Luke Skywalker thing, there's a link in there back to the Star Wars. They're bidirectionally linked. They're linked to each other. These two things are connected. And when you go to Luke Skywalker, it's probably connected to Mark Hamill, which is the actor who played Luke Skywalker. Those two things are connected. Okay? Well, you know what Wikipedia looks like. And for the most part, that's basically what Rome and Obsidian look like, right? It's text with some images thrown in. But a graph view, both of these apps have something called a graph view. What the graph view is, it doesn't actually show you the note. It shows you the note represented by a dot. And then it shows you all the other notes it's connected to as other dots. And then the lines between them. So if you clicked on Luke Skywalker, you would see a dot, and it would just be a dot, and it said Luke Skywalker above it, and a line going to the right, connecting to another dot, and that dot would say Mark Hamill, and then a line going to the left, and another dot, and connected to that, I mean, the name of that dot would be Star Wars, and maybe there would be another line going up to a dot above, and that one says Darth Vader, and then down here you have Yoda, and over here you have Princess Leia. You have C-3PO over here. R2-D2 over here. And going off of Mark Hamill, you have Joker from Batman the Animated Series. You know, all of these connection. It's a visual representation of the connections between the notes. That's what the graph view is. Both of these apps deal with it in different ways. Not super important, but just to help you a little bit. Rome is more linear. Everything is more in a line, and you end up with something that looks square. Obsidian is like it's more orbital, more planets. You end up with something that looks like circles. Okay? So the reason I'm telling you about the shapes is because even though I'm a Rome research user, Obsidian's graphs, they're better to look at just from a visual point of view. Not only because the roundness looks better than the squareness, but because the Rome research one is black and white and gray, and this one is black background with, if you're using dark theme, black background with colored nodes and colored lines, so it's more visually appealing. So I'm watching this, and I'm like, this is a beautiful little graph. And that's all I'm thinking about. I'm not even paying attention to what this person in the video, I don't even remember the name of this video. And one of the things they start talking about is the color of these nodes. There's purple nodes in this graph, and there are gray nodes in this graph. And these aren't arbitrary choices. They have meanings. And they have meanings that, as a Rome research user, meanings that didn't make sense to me. Don't worry, guys. We're not going to be talking technical about notes the whole time if you're worried about that right now. I just need to get through this so that you can understand where I'm going with this. This is part of my metaphor. But anyways, the difference here is the purple nodes have pages. You know, if you have a note in your Obsidian for Luke Skywalker, and it's purple, that means that there's text inside of the note. It means you've made an actual note of it. If it's gray, it means you've linked it somewhere, but there's no actual page made. It's like a placeholder. The gray ones are placeholders. This concept is foreign to someone who uses Rome, because when you link something, it makes a page, the end, which can be a pain sometimes because you spell something wrong and you end up with a page with the wrong spelling. You have to go delete it. Happens all the time. So I'm watching this and I'm like, oh, immediately a little bit jealous. Not a huge bit, because that's just a minor thing. You know, like every once in a while I make the wrong page, I go delete it, whatever. But a tiny bit of jealousy. Your graph looks a little better. That's a neat little feature. And then they start doing something with this person in the video starts doing something with these purple and gray nodes that just made me actually very jealous. And there's a filtering feature in there. And what you can do is you can turn on and turn off those gray nodes. So those placeholders, you can either see them or you cannot. And what this person was doing was using this feature to turn off and on the placeholder notes to show them where ideas were developing. I don't want to go into a lot of it, but essentially what this person was saying is, if you have this purple note and you've been writing stuff like about things related to this purple note, and you have all these other purple nodes coming off of it, if you look at the gray ones, those are places that are connected to all this stuff you've been talking about that you haven't written about yet. So he was using this visual filtering to find ways to find areas similar to what he'd already written about, things he was already interested in that he had yet to explore. And I thought, wow, that is such a wonderful way to take something that's maybe the idea of filtering something visually, you wouldn't think about it as a useful tool. So immediately, wow, like this feeling about Obsidian, like Obsidian's really cool. And like I said, it's a competitor with Rome, and I'm a Rome user. So I had this, like, I had note-taking envy. And so I end up watching a couple more videos on Obsidian and just learning about it. You know, I don't know much about it because I've never used it. So watching videos of the way people use it and seeing the differences, and immediately I think I tweeted something along the lines of, I watched a couple videos, saw the differences, realized Obsidian is really cool, but I'm most definitely a Rome research user, because there were things that you couldn't do you can't do with obsidian that you can do with Rome. And I thought that that was settled. But it stuck around. And, you know, we're all in lockdown, or mostly lockdown, and we're at home. So it's really easy to dwell on things. And that's something I found myself dwelling on. So the reason I originally I moved to Rome Research was essentially because my note-taking app before was Evernote. Now, I didn't move from Evernote directly to Rome. I bounced around a lot and never really found a place where I was happy. But Evernote was the first note-taking app, digital note-taking app, that was really important to me. I used to throw stuff in there, and I would look forward to Sundays where I would sit down in my inbox and just look at what I collected and move it to the right places and put all the tags. But then after a couple years, I started to realize what a lot of people will say if they used Evernote for a long period of time. You realize that you're collecting shit for no reason. So I've got articles and articles in here that I've never searched. I've never gotten back to that article. Why did I save it? I have all of these pictures and these memes and things that I've never looked at again. Why am I collecting this? And you realize that the app, without intending to, is incidentally encouraging you to become a hoarder. You're becoming a digital hoarder. That's neat. Save it. Throw it in your Evernote. That email, you might need to read that email again. Don't archive it in your email app. Save it in an Evernote. That email that you, that article you just read, web clip it. Take every word. You know, don't just take the notes. Take the whole article. That kind of thinking, which in certain circumstances is absolutely, if you are reading a lot of scientific papers and you need to research those things and you need to go back to them, of course, that's useful. But these things are only useful if you actually use them, right? If you're collecting this stuff and you're actually going back to it, then it's useful. That's the definition. That's what useful means. But if you're doing this stuff without any use, it's not useful. So I left Evernote and I went on a journey for other things. Eventually, I ended up in Rome. So here I am thinking about this other app, Obsidian. And I started to, for months, I've been feeling this uneasiness with Rome. It's this amazing tool, but I hadn't found a system. Actually, there's a guy who has a podcast called Rome FM. His name's Norman Chella. Great guy, great program. He brings in basically all different kinds of users of Rome Research and talks about use cases. So it's a great way to learn about this app. And him and I had been DMing on Twitter, and I told him that I was feeling this sense of like I was floating, like I had nothing to hold on to. Because Rome Research is so free form. I was putting so much stuff in there, but then I was realizing like when I would go to sit to write something or I would go to sit to make notes for an episode, I would find this huge cognitive load of trying to figure out where all the different pieces I needed to collect were collected. And I'm sure to some degree, a lot of that's it's my fault. It's not the app's fault, that's for sure. It's not what it's built to do. But it just, I've been feeling like I wasn't completely gelling with it. And what I realized is that it had become another Evernote for me that I had been hoarding. And Rome Research encourages you, I'm almost done with all this technical talk, stick with me, but Rome Research encourages you to make a note for everything that's important. I mean, make a link to a note. You know, every time, like I said, you make a link, it creates a page. So you make a note. But you end up with all these pages that, you know, like if I'm reading about Star Wars and it mentions Darth Maul, I put the double brackets around the word Darth Maul. Now I know that there's a page out there with Darth Maul that exists. But here's the thing. That page is just a link. There's nothing there. I didn't have anything to say about Darth Maul. I just made a link to create that page because one day I might have something to say about Darth Maul. So it encourages this behavior called what I like to call link hoarding. You end up with all these links, but there's really no content to them. Now, the more you use the app, the more things are going to start to connect, the more those pages will start to fill, and then you'll see the connections between, you know, these pages. If I had no words on the Star Wars page, it would still be a valuable page because it would be what is called a map of content. It has connections to Mark Hamill. It has connections to Darth Vader. It has connections to C-3PO. It has connections to R2-D2. So there might not be any words on that page, but because it's connected to all these things, I can see how all these things are connected through Star Wars. But if you have pages that only have one link coming into them, they're essentially useless. So you're hoarding again. And once I realized that, I started thinking about how that was affecting my brain. Because when I went and I looked at the list of pages, I felt overwhelmed. And I felt overwhelmed because there were all these, just so much that I didn't even know what was in there. And because I didn't have like a skeletal framework that held it all together for me, that's why I was feeling adrift. And it made me to actually start to reevaluate. I downloaded Obsidian. Obsidian's a free app. I just started playing around with it just to see if there's anything about it that I was missing. And I started to see the differences between the two, and there'd be friction between the two. But in that friction, I started to rethink things. And I started to realize a little bit about gestalt, that loose thread. But there was this loose thread. I've been looking for loose threads at other places in my life. There was this loose thread in my note-taking. That the feeling that I couldn't, that when I went into Rome, that I didn't have a feeling like I was sitting down to my command center. When you're a writer or an extensive note-taker, when you sit down to your note-taking system, whether it's a notebook or whether it is an app, you should feel like you are strapping into the command center, that this is your space. This is the collection of your thoughts and you are in control of it. And these are all the pieces that you're going to move around and you're ready to do something. And I didn't feel that way when I would log into Rome. In fact, I would just live in the daily pages, almost like hiding from the reality of what I was feeling underneath, this unresolved gestalt. But just because I realized I didn't suddenly come to this realization and everything was fine and then I figured everything out and I didn't just decide, I'm just going to switch apps and that's going to solve everything, because years and years of screwing around with apps and jumping around, I learned that that usually makes the situation worse. The jumping apps is you end up with all those loose threads again because you don't move them all over. So, you know, like, well, I've got 150 notes over here in day one. I'll move those over eventually. So, you know, maybe you move over 50, but there's still 100 sitting there. I've got this folder of documents that I want to put in here, but I've only moved over like 30. There are still 70 in this folder that's left unresolved. I have some stuff left in Evernote still. Let's move that over eventually, but, you know, not right now. So you end up with like these 10, every app you go to, you leave debris, you know, you're littering. And then there's something in the back of your head remembering like, you know, you got to go over there and pick the shit up off that lawn, and you got to go over there and you got to pick up that reindeer, that lawn reindeer, and pick up that lawn flamingo. All these little things that are keeping warm in the back of your head. Little things reminding you where you got to go back. So I didn't want to jump apps. And I didn't think I could, because I was looking at the difference in the way they functioned. And, well, I can do that over here. I can't do that over here. So if I can't do that over here, am I going to have to find a workaround? You know, this kind of thinking. But I stuck with it. I stuck with this type of thinking, because when I'm thinking like that, I'm doing better than I was when I was avoiding things. because at least I'm willing to make things tangible, to create pieces, to move around, to write things on index cards and rearrange them. It's a better place than the place of, oh, I'm too tired to move today. Guess I'll just not look at my email. You got to get past that, right? Kind of where we started. So the way that I kind of dealt with this in the interim is I just watched more videos. Okay, fine. I just told myself, if I'm trying to figure this out, let's see how other people are dealing with the problems I have that use Obsidian, how they do the things that I was doing in Rome. And for the most part, people found workarounds, stuff I didn't want to do. Like, that works, but that's really complicated. I will never do that. You took something that was one step in that app and it takes 25 in this one. Not going to do it. Then I watched this video. This video by a guy named Curtis McHale. And it's called Using Obsidian to Take Notes on Books. So, of course I clicked it. Obsidian, something I'm interested in at the moment. Notes and books, two things I'm always interested in. All three words in one title. And two things in this video that kind of has shifted a lot of things for me. The first is he does something similar to what I've always been drawn to and at times have gone back and forth on, which is doing notes in paper notebooks, as we were talking about earlier in this episode, and moving the notes to digital afterwards. But his way of doing it is so different because he doesn't believe that everything that makes it in the notebook needs to end up in digital. That the notebook is for collecting everything, and then the digital is for collecting, I guess, for him, maybe the best shit. And that's a very different way of looking at things. Because that insinuated connection that I mentioned before of the connection between paper notes insinuating eventually that they'll all be digitized, that's a black or white type of thinking. But here's somebody that comes along with a gray, and a gray thought can be revolutionary. And then he started going through the way that he does his structures, his book notes. And for the most part, this is the way I would generally think about book notes. Here's all the stuff from the book I liked, highlights. Here's all the things I thought about it. That's my structure, right? This guy has everything divided up into sections, and he doesn't have anything that looks like what I'm talking about. So he would have a section that said key ideas, and then he would create notes to other notes that are titled the names of those key ideas, like Star Wars. What's a key idea of Star Wars? That goodness is a force in the universe that you can tap into. And that would be a note, a separate note. So his book note wouldn't be just like a list of highlights. It was actually the process. It was the aftermath of a process of thinking and analyzing the information. So instead of taking stuff from this, putting everything in this paper notebook, taking it, transferring it, all of it over into this digital notebook and basically having the same thing in two places. What this guy is doing, I assume he's still doing this, is he's putting everything into the paper notebook. And then he's sitting down and he's looking at the paper notebook and going, what's valuable in what I've written here? What is useful in what I've written here? And then he's taking those things and he's thinking about them and he's distilling them into new thoughts, into pieces that can be used for something. And it made me think also about the rush. The rush that, like, I've written this on paper, let me transfer it into digital. Because essentially the ideal system in my head with this was always take my notes for the day on paper, and then in the end of the night, type it into the computer. And that if I felt like if I could ever do that, then I felt like I was on top of everything. But what was the rush? What is the rush to transfer it from there to there? It goes back to that Elizabeth Chatwin comment about living with those ideas. Where am I living with the ideas if all I'm doing is moving them from the book into the notebook onto the computer? Where's the dwelling? Where's the living with them? Where's the contemplating? Where's the editing? So why move them now? Why not let them sit? And this is the reason that note-taking, we've talked about note-taking so much, is because going through all of this, I realized that initial event, that initial quake event that was leading to this avalanche of depression and maybe anxiety was not the state of my room. That the state of my room was only a symptom of the event that I'm talking about. And the event was my notes and my thinking weren't organized. And because my notes and my thinking weren't organized, everything else felt like a burden. Because I didn't have a handle on the way that I was collecting my thoughts and arranging my thoughts and putting my thoughts together, I was too tired mentally to do the 2 minutes of work that it takes to clean off these two shelves right here. And by the time it came to having to call the dentist and it came time to have to call the credit card company, I was overloaded because my base, my core being is so related to thoughts and note-taking that with that disruptive, with that as living as an unresolved gestalt, that everything else was symptomatic, was created into a state of chaos, mirroring it. You know, I had a small way, a similar revelation to this a month or two ago. I'd always bought like Moleskine notebooks, and then I got into the Leuchtturm 1917 notebooks, these fancy notebooks, hard covers, numbered pages, dot pages, beautiful paper. You can use a fountain pen in them. Just nice notebooks, right? And I'd used those for years and years. And one of the problems I always had, and this is something very common for a lot of people who try to use these notebooks, is you start to feel a little sacred about them. You don't want to mess them up. You know, like you abandon them when you, like, oh, I made a messy page. And then for some reason you feel like you ruined the notebook. Like, oh. Because there's like maybe people who buy these, like these notebooks are thinking someday somebody is going to look at this notebook. So I don't want it to be messed up. So what I did a couple months ago is I had this spiral notebook, like Mead $2 spiral. They're probably like $4 now, but when I bought it, it was $2. Something from what I could tell from 20 years ago. You know, some notebook I had bought for either high school or for college. I picked it up and I just started taking my notes in there. And what I found was immediately a difference. That before I would be stingy about what I put in my fancier notebooks. And the moment I picked up this cheap one, I was writing all over and circling things and writing things in the margins. And it was like my thinking had all of a sudden been let out of this cage. And the cage was this idea of the way that this notebook should be. Now, I've been using the spiral notebooks enough recently that I can pick up one of the fancier ones, and I act exactly the same way in the fancier ones now. But I had to break out of that way of thinking. It's not the notebook so much as the mindset. Too much restraint is similar to the idea of digitize everything. It's this closed mindset. You've assumed this is the way things work, and you've created like a box or a little prison. So what I started to wonder is, if I can write that much in notebooks, then why would I be worried about digital stuff? Because the thinking, so much thinking going on in these notebooks. So what if I could take the notebook and just make it this place where I do everything in it? Like I've been talking about, live inside the notebook. But then instead of rushing and worrying about getting it to the digital, let it sit. And then maybe when it's complete, when I get to the end of the notebook, pick it up and start reading it from the beginning. Or pick up an old one. You know, it doesn't have to be the most recent one I completed. Pick up one of my notebooks and start reading through it. And when I'm reading through it, look for useful ideas. Not think about, I have to take everything from here, but do what this Curtis McHale guy was doing and going, what in here is useful? And taking those useful ideas and then taking those and putting that into Obsidian. So instead of making the digital format a collect everything, make it a place where I work with thoughts. And let the notebook be the place that connects everything. And that little tweak, I instantly felt relief that that gestalt was suddenly completed. I had suddenly picked up the loose thread. And it wasn't because of the app. It was just because the limitation of the app inspired that. And why eventually did I decide to move from Rome to Obsidian? Simple. One's free and the other one's not. And if I can get the same thing out of either of them, then it makes no difference to me. I'd recommend either of them, to be honest. They're both beautiful and powerful apps. But now I had this idea of what a new system could be. And the moment that I had that resolve, the moment that I could see that complete, I really understood what Blind Boy was talking about with that completion of gestalt. And the moment I realized that, I could see that everything else was a symptom of that so clearly, because it became less exhausting to think about cleaning that shelf, less exhausting to think about making phone calls, because all of those were coming off of that initial unresolved feeling. And the weird thing happened is some of my seasonal depression lightened. That when you feel you're on track, when you feel you're moving towards something, there's a certain self-confidence that comes with that. And that erases some depression. It doesn't get rid of all of it. You know, whatever the physiological thing that's going on, I'm not going to be able to change that probably. But if I could get this on track and I can feel all of this stuff is working, then that might give me that 10 or 15% that I was talking about earlier. That gives me equilibrium. And ultimately, it's a good thing for me that some of the features in Obsidian are, you can't do the things you can do in Rome as easily, because it prevents me, or at least it pushes back. That resistance pushes back on me becoming a link hoarder. And when I started moving a couple notes over, I noticed the difference there. And I would put down some notes from Hitch 22, the memoir by Christopher Hitchens. And then my natural tendency from using Rome for so long was to immediately begin to create a page for Christopher Hitchens. But then I realized, I'm like, I don't have anything additional to say about him at this moment. The only thing that is notable about him in my notes at this moment is that he wrote this book. So I could just type his name and not create a page, not create a link, and just let it wait. So that eventually when I had enough references to him that I felt I had something to say, that I had a page to create, I could do that. And then I would never feel that overwhelm again. And it makes sense when you think about shelves. Think about how they get cluttered. You know, well, I don't know where this goes, and let me just put it here. I grew up with a family who's pretty much one step below hoarders. My grandfather used to save everything. These nails, one could be slightly bent. Well, you never know. You might need it one day, and it's better to have it. No, it's not. You could just, it's a nail. When you need a nail, you could just go to the store and buy one for like a penny. It's, nails are not expensive. You don't need to save them. We don't need to hoard. We don't need to hoard things. We don't need to hoard, even in the digital world. Because, sure, maybe it doesn't cost any more to have more notes than it costs to have less notes. But that doesn't mean that you need those notes, because there is an overwhelm and there is an unresolved gestalt and all of that and collecting things you don't need, because there is a little voice in the back of your head going, all this stuff, what are we going to do with it? This little voice in the back of your head, it's always asking you, is this a good time to use this? And if you never use it, then that voice just has been screaming for no reason. When we go to bookstores, we don't buy every book we see. We buy the books that we think we're going to read, that we want to read. We don't buy all of them. So why should I be taking every note that I've written in this notebook and moving it over to the place where I try to develop thoughts into writing or into episodes? Why shouldn't I just be moving over the ones that I think I have more to say about? In the Zettelkasten methodology, there's an episode, previous episode, I don't remember what the number is right now, I'll put the link here, where Lam and I talk about, Lam's on the show, this is when we were doing a show together, we talk about Zettelkasten. I break down what the whole idea of it is. But in Zettelkasten, there are essentially three types of notes: fleeting, literature, and permanent. The fleeting notes are buy dog food. You know, these are things you need and then you can throw away. This is not something you're going to archive. You know, it's just something you need for a period of time and then it's useless after that period of time is gone. It's fleeting. Its value is temporary. Literature notes are more what I'm talking about, what's going on in the notebooks. This is when you're reading, you write down the stuff that's interesting. And instead of calling them literature notes, because I feel like that's confusing, I actually call them just interesting notes. It's the stuff that I find interesting. It's the thoughts that I have that are interesting at the time in the moment. When you go back later, not all of them are valuable. And then you create, from the what's left, you create the permanent notes. And I actually, just to make it simple, I call these useful notes. You know, these are the notes that are useful. Useful in the sense that I'm going to use them. They are full of use. Not useful as in you can make an argument in the colloquial term of what useful means, that anything is useful. A fleeting note is useful until it's used, right? But useful in the term that I am going to use them. So fleeting notes, you know, whenever those happen, wherever they happen, whether it's the palm of your hand or in your phone, in a to-do app, literature notes in the notebook, permanent notes, also known as useful notes, in Obsidian. A system. Relief. A support structure to get me through not only the rest of the year, but in particular this time of year when things are difficult. You know, and another benefit of this actually that's really cool that I just realized before recording this episode is I don't read like most people do. I've probably mentioned this before. I don't just pick up, actually I did in one of the episodes that was originally a semi-literate episode. It was the episode after, I think, the ICE episode where I talked about Hyperbole and a Half. And I talked about how I was going to change that show because I wasn't reading books in a whole. I just wanted to bring in parts of books because that's how I read. I don't just pick up a book and go, I'm into this book and this is my book until I'm done with it. That's not me. I have about 12 books on my coffee table right now that I'm reading. And I just pick up one and maybe I read 5, 20, 40 pages, whatever I feel like at the moment. The next time I sit down and feel like reading, I probably pick up a different one. I'm drifting. I'm looking for ideas. I'm just feeding my interests. So by doing everything in the notebooks, I can do that more easily, right? It doesn't matter. Just throw it in there. They'll all make sense later. You can, if you want to combine all of the thoughts about the ideas about that one book, well, when you put it into your system, you can do it then. But for right now, just write down what you're thinking about now. Write down just what you find interesting right now. Follow your interests. Jump books indiscriminately. don't worry about dating things because the dates never mattered anyways. Because when you find a snag, like a big snag, like my thoughts weren't organized, this type of snag, what you start to see is that all of these other snags are connected, not only in the sense that they're injuries or their aftershocks of the initial earthquake, but that in some way they're similar or related. You know, like my scattered notes and my scattered thoughts manifested in my scattered room, my scattered coffee table, my desire for notebooks and my need to bounce between books. They were connected. And I just wasn't seeing the connection. So I think it is possible to see those early signs of depression and anxiety and to do things to mitigate it, to stop the avalanche. You might not stop the feeling, but you can stop the thing that knocks you down and bowls you over. That you can go around, you can pick up those loose threads and you can complete shit. And now because I have that complete, you know, my room will get cleaned. Phone calls will get replied to, or phone calls will get made and emails will get replied to. But I also have neat little projects that I can do now. Things that make me feel good. Like going through Rome and taking all of the notes, not moving them to Obsidian, throwing away the ones that are useless to me. And writing everything in the notebook to be discovered later. And that's fun for me. And because that's fun for me, and because it's a project, and because I feel like I'm accomplishing something, all of a sudden I feel so much better. That not just resolving that unresolved thing gave me a little bit of reprieve, but then this other thing that's attached to that gives me a little bit more. And this one over here gives me a little more self-confidence. And this one over here just brings me some joy. And this one gives me something to do while I'm watching TV on paper like I did when I was a kid. And I think, maybe the reason I don't like normally talking about mental stuff, mental health, mental illness, mental handicaps, it's not only because I don't have the right words for it, or I don't feel like there are right words for it, but because I don't like talking about things that I can't resolve. So maybe the reason that I was able to talk about this in this episode is because I've come to a sort of resolution. Resolution and solution are things that come up together. I didn't find a solution here. Or maybe I have it backwards. I've found a solution, but I haven't found a resolution. You know, this is not going to end, but I've found something that works. I've found the wheelchair, the crutch, the medication, the thing that allows me to go about my daily life and to build a life with what I have to work with. The thing that allows me to step over the stone instead of stop and stare at it like a metal monolith in the Arizona desert. So I think we're almost at an hour and a half here. I think that's enough for now. I think I've got out everything. I went through all my index cards. I got out all of the thoughts that I had inside. I expressed something. So I think we're good. If you want to chat at me and tell me maybe how you go through this stuff, how you feel about this stuff, whether it's note-taking or mental health, you can find me on Twitter at The Real Chat Hall. Give me a follow, give me a tweet, say hello. If you want to support me, you can do one of the two ways in the notes below, in the description below. You can either give me a one-time donation via Ko-fi, or you can become a patron. Or on, yes, you guessed it, Patreon. Two tiers over there. Basically the same thing, just depends on how much you want to give. It's a tough time of year for everyone. I don't expect you to do it, but if you can, be awesome, because it's rough over here too. I gotta pay for this tooth somehow. And I gotta pay off those debtors. Oh man, don't want to think about that right now. Bye.